from Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio, focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. And we're rejoicing and being glad because we're welcoming in the most recognizable voice in the city of Sacramento, in the Diocese of Sacramento. I won't introduce him because he's got such a recognizable voice. Walt Gray, how are you?
Oh, you gave it away.
I gave it away.
Mayor Steinberg. Yeah, you kind of gave it away with the introduction.
Yes.
But I'll play the game. Bob Dunning for 200.
How you doing, buddy?
That's
double jeopardy.
We're always in double jeopardy, aren't we?
Boy, are we. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Walt Gray joins us, ABC 10 anchor, very familiar face and voice here in throughout Sacramento, MC, dad of the year, husband of the year. You got it all going for you, Walt.
You're gonna get some pushback on that last one, but you know I'll take it.
well, and we should point out that we're because of COVID, we're not even talking on the phone. We're talking with tin cans and a piece of string.
My phone's not very good. I was talking to your producer Gabe, and I was trying every cell phone that I have in the house, and it's dropping here and dropping there, and I'm like, it's totally my fault. Like, everything that happens within this house is my fault anyway, so I'll just take this one, too.
I know that. We have kids similar age. I have four teenagers.
Yeah.
And, it's... And if my phone doesn't work, then I ask them to fix it, you know, because I don't know how to fix it. Yeah.
Well, it's funny. My oldest daughter, who's now away her freshman year at Marquette University
in Milwaukee,
yeah, so... When my wife and I would have any issues internet-wise or computer-wise, we just call Abby. And Abby would come down, and she would fix it because, kids today, they just know stuff.
They're born with it.
They just know stuff that we don't. So,
And I've had the pleasure of having dinner with you and Abby a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We've done the St. Vincent de Paul dinner every year. It's going to be a little different this year, but... Every year, I take one of the kids because it's a pretty big event.
It is.
You're at the table. The bishop's at the table. We usually have a couple of other, high rollers.
Yeah, right.
You can say that. But very prominent Catholics at the table. Let's just say it that way. And so it's one of the most enjoyable things that I do, Bob, with the diocese, for the diocese. It's actually one of the rare things that I actually look forward to.
Yeah.
As you know, in the business, you do many things. Some of them are out of obligation, which is fine. Some of them, you get through. This is something that, to me, has always been very enjoyable. Just the people, the speakers, everything. It's a great night.
It is a great night, and obviously you do a great job, and people are you take an event that's a 9 and turn it into a 12. I'll tell you.
Well, thank you. It's very, you're too kind. It's I don't have a ton to do with the night other than not make too big of a mess of it. Just move it along. But the only thing through the years I think that I've had input in is who's ever organizing and donating their time is to make sure the guest speaker doesn't go too long.
Yes,
that's, as you know, that has happened upon occasion.
It does happen.
With any event we go to. And if I know the guest speaker, I may work out one of those baseball third base coach hand signal things to them where, if I start tugging on my ear, I'm not scratching it. That means you need to wrap it. So, we all have things like that as part of the MC business, but I really enjoy that night. So,
yeah, and,
I hope to do it next year.
It's interesting because I've accused Paul Starkey, who is one of the people that helps put together, that it kind of has a Notre Dame bent to it.
Yeah.
Sometimes we have guests. Of course, your wife's a Notre Dame alum, is that right?
She grew up in South Bend. Which is the funny thing to bring that up. So born and raised in South Bend, and when her choice for college came around, the only place she didn't want to go was Notre Dame because that's the local school.
Sure.
And kids in high school, it's like, they don't want to go to the local school, no matter how good it is. But she really had no idea how good Notre Dame was academically and all that until she went to University of Florida, but she had no idea. And so her dad went to Notre Dame Law. Her brother graduated with a MBA Notre Dame Business. And so they're huge Notre Dame people. And that was one of the great things when I first met my wife and then we later married, is that we were fortunate to go back there every year for the big opening game tailgate. So all of that stuff that I grew up watching, you know, on Saturday morning or Sunday morning TV with Lindsey Nelson. All those, the Notre Dame replays with the famous line of let's move to further action in the fourth quarter.
Exactly.
All of that. I finally, the band marching through campus, you know, on the way to the game, I'm like, wow, this stuff's for real.
And the Grotto.
I mean, it still is. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's great. So, yeah.
Wow,
my daughter's at Marquette. My daughter's now at Marquette getting the Catholic college experience, and she's really enjoying it, and even braving the weather too. So it's working out pretty well.
Do they have a shrine there to El McGuire?
No, they don't have a shrine. They do have a very, very cool grotto, which is kind of like Notre Dame, in the center of campus, and a very historic small chapel that's in the center of campus. If anybody's ever been to Marquette, Bob, I was there in October, and what amazed me was what a great town Milwaukee is.
I had
no knowledge of Milwaukee, and I went there, and I'm like, this is like a mini Chicago without all of the stuff.
Yeah.
So, and I happened to be there in mid-October, and it was perfect weather. The next weekend, when I wasn't there, is when the snow started. So I was out of there. I got out while the getting was good, and it's been cold there ever since. So.
Well, that's a great. I know that wanting to get out of town, though. We have a high school senior, and she has applied to every school in America except UC Davis.
Well, you know, I tried to sell my daughter Abby on Davis. I said, it's a great school, and it's close to home, yet when you're in Davis, as you know, it's the People's Republic of Davis.
Right. Yeah.
You might as well be 100 miles from here.
Right.
And but she wanted to go do her thing. And, you know, Davis would have been extremely happy with Davis or Cal.
Yeah.
She wanted to get on with getting on. And, you know, I understand all that. So,
Marquette's a great choice.
Yeah. We're happy with it. And, she's doing well. She got some, academic grants and scholarships to try to get that tuition down because those schools are, They're not community college prices,
yes,
as you know. So, where's Maeve going? Where's your daughter Maeve looking at?
Well, this is the next daughter. Maeve actually, you got the names right. Maeve is, and she's the one that always comes to me to St. Vincent de Paul. She is going to UC Davis. It's the next one, Emmy.
Oh, good.
And she's looking at one of the Catholic schools. She got in the University of Portland, but it's the same thing. Wow, the tuition.
Yeah.
But they did, so they offered her a great ride. And then she's, you know, Cal, Stanford, you know, most of the UCs except UC Davis and NYU, Notre Dame, you know, the usual, a few of the Catholic schools mixed in and then a lot of the UCs.
Yeah.
And she actually got an interview with Stanford. So, but that's like a one in a million shot, you know.
Yeah, well. That's the reason why you and I are both be working till we're 80.
Oh, easy.
Because
we've got younger
children who want to go to non-affordable school. So that's the price we pay for having young children. We knew we were going to pay for it somehow.
Yeah, I mean, she got a letter from University of Portland. Congratulations, on and on and on and on and on, you know.
Yeah.
And they offered her, like, over 4 years, like $100,000. I said, this is great. You know, you tell them you want to check right now. And then we checked the tuition and added all up. And I was going, it still wasn't enough.
No.
You know.
What's weird about it is a lot of these schools are around 65.
Yeah, just for tuition.
Year.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, how do we work this down? How do we make it work?
Right.
And, you know, just to circle back, the whole Catholic University experience, she's just really, really enjoyed it. And she didn't go there for that. I mean, you know, we go to Sunday church, you know, at Holy Spirit.
Right.
And so, but it's not, you know, it wasn't her thing to say, oh, there are some other schools here, but I definitely want to go to a Catholic school.
Right.
It just happened that it worked out, and you know that it's gravy. It really has been a good experience.
That's great. Well, the editor of the Sacramento Catholic Herald, Julie Sly, is a Marquette graduate.
Good. Good to know that. I think we knew that, and I remember Monica mentioning that that either her or there were some other people locally who had gone to Marquette.
Father Steve Avella is who is a historian, a great Sacramento historian, wrote a great book about the diocese, about the McClatchys, and he's a professor of history at Marquette. But he's a local Sacramentan as well. So, in fact, he gave the homily at Bishop Quinn's funeral.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm duly noting all these names in case she needs bail money.
Yes,
and
right.
So
right.
I've got a short list going here.
Oh, man.
Oh, God forgive me, you know, but it's true. Hey, you never know these days. You just want them to be safe and enjoyable. And if they're anything like me, my kids, then they're in deep, deep trouble because I'm surprised I'm still standing after what I did. So that's a story for another Catholic show.
Well, it's a story for the confessional, and good. Thank God there's a seal of confession.
The last time I was in confession, the priest walked out, and he's like, I've never heard stuff like that. So I thought perhaps I had confessed too much.
So,
Bishop Soto, if you're hearing this, I'm just kidding.
Yes, yes. We are with Walt Gray from the anchor for ABC 10. Walt, how long have you been in Sacramento media?
I got here in March of 1988 and was working at KCRA, the NBC station,
right.
And did sports there for the first 5.5 years and got to spend 2 or 3 beautiful autumn football seasons with you at my side calling Aggie football games
that
on
was
KCRA. And,
so much fun.
That was a lot of fun. That's when local stations did a lot of that. And I'm glad that, you know, that was a magic time to – we got to travel a little bit, you know, where we had games at Santa Clara. They had a team.
ULP.
San Francisco State had a team.
Yeah,
you know, St. Mary's had a team.
Right.
Sonoma State had a team. Chico had a team.
Yeah.
So those
Chico,
were
all
the
of
regional
them.
Games that we did. Yeah, those are the regional games that we did, and I really missed that part of it. But, you know, the fact that I had a chance to do it, it's like, okay, you're not going to do it every year forever. So the fact that, you know, I got many years out of that, I look back and just go, that was awesome. That was just a great time. I really appreciated that.
Such great memories of it. And, you know, it's like we were doing 7 games a year. Yeah, I remember one year, I think we did a doubleheader. I think we did Santa Clara in the afternoon and went over and did UOP and Sac State or somebody. You know, it was just
UOP had a team.
UOP had a team.
There's another one. UOP had a team.
Yeah.
Yes, we did 3 Aggie games. We did 3 Sac State games, and then we did the Causeway.
Right, right.
So it was a total of 7 in all, which is that's a busy schedule, local schedule.
That's huge.
But it was fun. I mean, you know, that was the early 90s for the two of us, and, you know, I don't have any regrets about, you know, moving out of sports and into news. News has been very enjoyable, too. So, you know, I've just been blessed. I think somebody said the other day to me that, like, if somebody would pass you a magic wand, what would you wish for? And I'd say, you know what? I'd give it to somebody else. I'm good.
Oh,
you know,
that's well put.
I don't want to be greedy. I think I've been very fortunate, and there's other people that need that magic wand. So, you know, thank you.
Yeah, no, I tell people it beats working for a living. You know,
if you have a job, no matter what you do, and you enjoy it, it really isn't a task.
Yeah.
It's something that you look forward to and you enjoy, and it makes an 8-hour day go by in 4 hours, seemingly. You know, it just makes a big difference. And, you know, I've never really had a bad experience or a bad day. You know, today I sent a couple of emails to the bosses that I probably would like to take back. But, you know, tomorrow's another day.
We really need an unsend button on the computer.
Gosh, yeah, today, to be honest, I could have used that. So, but it wasn't as bad as it could have been. But who knows, when I go in tomorrow, maybe I'm kidding myself. We'll see.
We retaped the interview. Former.
Yes. Who's now living in Wairika.
Right.
So who knows? Who knows? But I've had fun, and it's been a good experience. And we're trying to keep up, you know, getting back into the church swing of things on Sunday, and trying to watch it on the YouTube rebroadcast. Yeah. Christmas was it was different watching a mass on TV on YouTube, and it was just a whole different thing. But there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and it's coming quickly. And it's, the light is not an oncoming train, fortunately, which is good.
That's right. I heard something the other day that I never thought I'd hear as we were sitting in the living room watching Mass from St. James in Davis on TV. And our 16-year-old son, at the end of Mass, he says, "I miss going to Mass." I was like,
What? Really?
Really? Do you miss the donuts after? What? It was great.
Wow.
It was wonderful.
Explain, or did you just take that moment and not want to have him embellish and just...
That's right. I did. I just froze it. I said, we're freezing this. We're putting this one in the vault. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, he may come back and say, I was sort of kidding. who knows? But that's refreshing, and it shows me that probably when he goes off on his own, that, Sundays, wherever he is, he may, just to be grounded and just to be based and just to check in, he may find, an 11 a.m. Mass at whatever town he's in, and that'll be a good thing for him.
It'd be a great thing.
We've all done that and gone through that, no matter where we've been, that we need an hour out of our week to sit there and just kind of, just be with the Spirit. And I think that's vital, I think, especially these days.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's been a rough year for her, but we feel fortunate. We haven't gotten sick. Nobody either. And yet so many people suffered just tremendously, lost their jobs, lost their lives. It's hurt a lot of them, but, count your blessings every day.
I think that's important, and I'm glad you said that. And people will say, "Gosh, this is terrible, isn't it?" And I'll be like, "You know what? We're doing okay comparatively."
Yeah.
When you bring up the other scenarios of having seen a lot of things happen, and it's like, "What's our problem?" The kids are bored. Somebody's working from home and getting on somebody's nerves, and it's like, okay, in perspective, that's nothing. It's nothing compared. So I think it's good to look at the whole picture, and that way you kind of feel better about whatever you're going through.
Well, how do you integrate your faith and some of the news that you have to report? You're supposed to be nonpartisan, non-judgmental, just give us the straight news, but how can you be?
It's hard. But you have to focus on the task at hand. You have to focus on what your job is, and you have to focus on, trying to be down the middle. And it's a great fight that I have, I think, in journalism, in television, and is to try to make sure that both sides' stories are told, and to let the listener, viewer, or reader make up their own mind. I'm just trying to provide information. I would say one of the most difficult times I had, it's a slightly colorful story, was that I jumped on the set and was reading the news, and a story popped up about a priest that I knew at a church that I went to who had been pulled over having left an event and had had perhaps a glass of red too many, and was taken into custody, but I'm reading this and I'm like, oh my gosh, this guy I know very well. And that was very difficult to read, that knowing that he probably was going to hear that I did the story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, hey, Father, I'm sorry. I couldn't not read the story, and I wasn't making up a story. It actually happened. So I wasn't lying to anyone, but I was very uncomfortable. And I think you get that when you're doing a story about people or a situation that you're very familiar with,
yep,
you cannot not be attached to it because you're a human being, you know, and it's hard. I would say the hardest thing, Bob, is, you know, having gone a long time before I got married and had kids. Once I had kids, and then I was doing stories about child abductions, mm-hmm, or things happening to children, it was really hard for me to read those stories because now I had perspective, yep, as a parent as to what those parents must be going through. Before, I would just read it. I wouldn't be attached to it. But now it's different because I have that perspective. So that's what's different, I think.
Yeah, that's so true. I know every time I hear a one of those tearing your heart apart kids stories, you do. You put your child into that scene.
And yourself.
I mean, yeah.
You think, my gosh, there's something happened. I can only imagine being in that house,
right,
and waiting for a call,
right,
getting a call. It's not the call you want. It's somebody else. Somebody drives by. You think it's news. It's not. You just go, I have no idea how these poor people,
yep,
could deal with this emotionally. Yeah. And, you know, before I wouldn't be attached to it. But I just think it comes with getting older, you know, going through more experiences. And so that's the thing that I tell the young people I work with. I said, you know, I'll point some things out to them. And I don't say to them, this is the right way to do it. I will say, learn from my mistakes. I've made this mistake, and I don't want you to make that mistake. So I put it to them that way because I've been through more things and probably have more perspective. So I just find it's true, and it's a little more disarming than me telling them what they should do. I just say, don't do what I did.
I can relate. We have three of our kids right now all got their learner's permits at the same time. Dad, can we go to the store? I need something at the store. Okay, I'll drive you. No, I want to drive. In town?
Oh my gosh.
Really?
Oh, that's insane.
Oh.
That's insane.
There's nothing as stressful as sitting in the passenger seat with your 15, 16-year-old just got a permit. We go out in the country. I drive out in the country, and then we find a road that's abandoned except for a couple of cows. And then you just say, don't hit the cow. Don't hit the cow.
Have at it. Yeah. As long as you have them in those scenarios where you're comfortable and they're comfortable and you're not, you know, running into the other lane,
right,
you know, then it can be enjoyable. But that's a hectic one.
Yo.
And your car insurance must be, you're going to have to do many more of these shows, Bob, holy geez, three kids with permits. That's nuts.
All at the same time. It's just.
Yeah. That is. I've never heard that. Unless you had triplets.
AAA said the same thing. We've never heard of this.
But get your check in.
Yeah, we don't have a rate for that.
Oh, they'll find one for you. They'll make one.
Yeah. They'll probably have special rules how many kids can be in the car at the same time. Yeah.
That's a beautiful story. That's a beautiful story.
Yeah, I'll tell you. So,
mm-hmm,
so. As you look to the future,
you're
coming out of COVID. Are we gonna get better as a country?
Are you speaking from a health standpoint, or say a mental health standpoint?
I'd say a mental health standpoint. Yeah.
Mental health, does that involve politics?
I think a little bit.
I honestly can't answer that, and that's not good.
Yeah.
That's not me saying I can't answer that good. Yeah, I mean, I can't answer that, and I don't know, because as we stand now, and I'm just speaking, and it's true, I think we have a president of the United States who is the president of the Democratic Party. We also have a president of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
And with the vote, popular vote being what it is, I don't see any unification happening. So I think, you know, when we look at the midterms in 2022, we'll get a better read on where everything is. But I've never seen anything like that. I think social media is mostly to blame.
I think so.
And if people didn't have Twitter, people didn't. I mean, you know, of course, I'm speaking like I'm grandpa here, yeah. And there's no turning back. But I think having seen that Twitter adjusted some people's accounts and whatnot, that but I don't know that necessarily helped. I just think it helped stoke a fire.
Yeah.
And I don't know eventually where it's all going to go. I mean, things obviously are better and have calmed down since we, you know, turned the page after January 6th a little bit with the Capitol riot. But
right.
Even tonight, I think the Capitol has beefed up security.
Yeah,
because,
it is. Yep.
Yeah, and because something may happen tomorrow, just the picking stuff up on social media. But if there's any group now that wants to storm the Capitol, they're not going to get very far.
I don't think so.
That's to me, it's like pick another building. You know, don't pick that building. There's a lot of buildings in Washington that are not covered like the Capitol. So yeah. If you want to make a statement, I wouldn't go there.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Well, yeah, I've never seen anything like it either. And you know, that's why we have our faith. It's God.
Yes.
I tell the kids that every day. I say that God's still in charge. If you got up in the morning and looked in the mirror and you're still alive, there's a reason.
Yeah. Yeah, I tell people, honestly, that I feel a lot better when I'm disengaged from what I do, meaning I'm not watching news, I'm not on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, any of that stuff, and I go about my day. You know, I'm working in the backyard, may run to Home Depot, come in and grab a hamburger, and it's like, I'm good.
Yep.
I don't need the negative stimulus, and people say, you know, you watch the news at night. And it's like, no. I do the news all morning. And when I go home, I'm not really going to watch news because I feel like I'm back at the office. So I need a break, and everybody needs a break. And I encourage them to take a break if you're feeling overwhelmed by what's happening, you know, with your neighbors and this and that and pro this and anti that. It's just sometimes I just want to move to a small town in Iowa. And it has a general store, and I sit there in the front porch of the general store with my buddies, and, you know, and that's kind of the highlight of the day. And you go home and whip yourself up some mac and cheese, and it's all good. I'm a minimalist that way. I'm a minimalist.
Well, maybe after the emails you sent today, you'll get that wish.
It could be. yes. Yeah, that's very. I'm glad you brought it back to that. Thank you.
or Wairika. Wairika's in the diocese, you know. It's a great little town.
Maybe Bodega. At least I can go to the beach every day.
Yeah.
You know, give me Bodega. Something to do. There's clam cakes and some good fish over there. So I'll take that. I love Bodega. So
I'll take Bodega Bay.
I love it.
That's a great spot.
I love it.
Well, Walt,
yep.
So good of you to join us today. Thanks for all you do for the church, for this area, for, you know, the Sacramento Diocese, for St. Vincent de Paul, but just all you do for everybody, whether they're Catholic or not Catholic, your efforts are greatly appreciated. You're just part of the fabric of this town.
Well, thank you. I've been here for a long time. That's it. So I think that's most of it. But I do appreciate those kind words, and it's always great to break bread with you or to talk to you on the radio or the phone or whatever. So stay in touch.
We will. God bless you and your family, man.
Okay.
Yeah.
Same to you.
Yeah.
All right.
Take care.
Buddy.
That's Walt Gray, the anchor for News 10 here, ABC News 10 in Sacramento, and a great Catholic who there are a lot of events that he goes to and I go to, and he's very, very, very generous with his time, and people are greatly appreciative of that, and he makes no secret of his love for the Catholic Church, and he'll bring up stories of from his childhood and from here in the diocese that he just of all the people that he's so fond of. So greatly appreciate Walt taking the time to be with us today. We'll take a quick break. Back with more on the Bishop's Hour right after this. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour.
This is Lincoln Snyder, Superintendent of Catholic Schools, and you're listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Dunning.
Welcome back, everyone. This is the Bishop's Hour. Appreciate you being with us on this beautiful day the Lord has made, and we're full of joy to welcome in Rabbi Seth Castleman, who is the director of the Exodus Project. Rabbi, good day to you.
Good day to you, Bob. Always nice to hear your voice.
Good to hear your voice, too. We had a couple of your excellent volunteers on the program in the last few days, Troy Ellerman and Faye Landry, and boy, did they have great stories to tell. And I guess walking billboards for the Exodus Project.
They are two wonderful human beings who do wonderful volunteer work and wonderful spiritual work and wonderful service work, so I'm honored to know them both.
Talk about that. Well, first, for those who have not heard you before on the air or heard me talk about it a little bit, just give us a thumbnail of the Exodus Project and
sure.
How it started and et cetera.
So the Exodus Project very much came out of the other work that the diocese is already doing in terms of prison and jail ministry throughout the diocese, and the people who are spearheading that and running that, and Bishop Soto himself, very much wanted to develop programming and services that met people from the moment that they left incarceration through their transition back into the community. So for a couple of years, we were planning to developing what this might look like, and the outcome started 2 years ago under the title Exodus Project and under the auspices of St. Vincent de Paul. So while it sort of germinated in the diocese and has been generously funded in part by the diocese, it's now a program of St. Vincent de Paul, which fits very nicely as their mission is for serving the poor and visiting the incarcerated and such. And we provide mentoring and housing, employment, other resources to people in their last months of incarceration, primarily those in county jail in Sacramento, but also people coming out of state prison, and then for about 6 months post-release. So we match up mentors, men with men and women with women. Once COVID stops, we'll start doing mentoring groups. And then we also have a staff that helps them with things like housing, things like employment, things like getting a driver's license and back on Social Security and things like that to help them on the external, but also the internal, the spiritual, the sobriety, the psychological.
So what's the role of St. Vincent de Paul in this?
So we are a special works of St. Vincent de Paul. So this is a program that is part of the St. Vincent de Paul organization for the Sacramento Diocese, and so their board is our board. We have our own advisory council as well, but they are big supporters, and quite a number of our mentors are Vincentians,
mm-hmm.
and this is very much part of the Vincentian mission,
part of what we do for people when they come out is give them vouchers to the wonderful St. Vincent de Paul thrift store up on Watt Avenue in Sacramento so people can get clothes and toys for their kids upon returning home and that sort of thing. Get a bed and furniture if they're moving into a new house or apartment.
So a lot of these people will be similar to other people that haven't or aren't incarcerated that St. Vincent de Paul deals with on a regular basis.
Correct, correct. And, of course, the interrelationship between poverty and incarceration is sadly very, very deep. So in terms of working with people in poverty, we're working with the incarcerated, and in working with the incarcerated, we're working with people primarily who are in poverty.
So what are the, of all the, you know, if we handed you the magic wand and it actually worked, what are the biggest problems that the people that the Exodus Project is serving? What are the biggest things that need to be fixed, alleviated, helped with?
Yeah. I would say the two big ones are addiction. Mm-hmm. And in Sac County, in this area, meth is still the big demon. That's mm-hmm. that's a real struggle for a lot of people, and getting people off of it is tough, and getting people to stay off of it is really tough. And then the other one is housing and homelessness. And the majority of people coming out of county jail after a significant stint in there of 6 months or longer are not going to have secure housing, and are going to be either literally on the street or couch surfing or trying to pay for a motel night by night, that sort of thing. So housing and addiction are really the two big things.
So when somebody, not involved with the Exodus Project, but when somebody has served their time, what they just walk out the door? Do they give them any cash, any clothes, any motel voucher? Is there anything for, like I say, leaving the Exodus Project out? Is there anything the state
right.
provides?
Well, so it's county, and that's part of the problem is that there's a lot more resources for people. I mean, there's not a huge amount, but there's definitely more for people coming out of state prison, out of CDCR.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're coming out of county, and now with realignment with 109, we put people that have sentences under 5-6 years
right.
for nonviolent offenses, we're putting them in county jail, and there are much fewer resources for people coming out of it, both in the jail, mm-hmm. but also for people coming out. So there are some treatment halfway houses type of things, and we now have a grant to start opening some as well with Sacramento Self-Help Housing to offer some interim housing for a few months for people. But there's not a lot, and it's not for very many people. So basically, you walk out the gate, and you got what you got.
Wow.
And they often, more often than not, they're letting you out at 2, 3 in the morning.
And
to make things a little bit trickier.
How is the expectation that they're not going to turn around and be right back in there?
Exactly. Exactly. The person that's going to pick you up at 2, 3 in the morning is most likely not going to be somebody that's
yep.
going to be leading you in a good direction.
Yeah. Why 2 or 3 in the morning?
You know, the best explanation that I've gotten, which wasn't directly from the sheriff's department, I've never gotten an explanation from the department, whom we work fairly closely with and have good relationships with. But the best explanation I've had is that they get paid for another day of housing them once they keep them past midnight. But I don't really know if that's the, I've never really gotten another answer that made sense.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah, it's hard to imagine. I mean, if somebody walks out, maybe 50-50, I don't know, that actually has a family to go to or mm-hmm. some sort of mm-hmm. stable house, probably doesn't have a job waiting for them.
Right.
And they've already turned to crime.
Yep.
Before, whether the crime was necessarily financial, I mean, to help them pay their bills
right.
or live, and if they didn't have a job before, boy, getting a job now with a record is even harder.
Yep, yep. And the same with getting a lease. First, you have to have the money, but also you need to have the credibility and the,
right.
the credit score and the not having been evicted and, yep.
Wow.
A lot of challenges.
The challenges are enormous. Do we know in the homeless population, how many, what percent of those people, or is because maybe they have a record of some kind and they've just kind of given up on trying to get into the back into society?
I think the because is hard to state, you know, what causes what.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that the majority of the homeless population, I believe the majority of the homeless population have done time in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, there's cause and effects in both directions.
Sure,
it's,
sure.
It's hard to stay sober on the street. It's hard to not break the law when living on the street. It's hard to stay out of the watchful eye of the criminal justice system when
sure.
living on the street.
Sure. So obviously you rely on volunteers for the Exodus Project, and I said we just talked to two great ones. What do they bring? What's expected of them, and how are they trained?
Right. So we have another training starting tonight, mm-hmm. and it's a 16 to 18 hour training. We do it two or three times a year. This cohort is a big one. We have about 23 people in this training, and we'll be doing it all by Zoom since we're still in the midst of this pandemic. But during that 16 to 18 hours, they're trained in everything from boundaries to working with trauma, to working with addiction, to what resources are out there, what resources we offer, to what the program is, and how to work with your mentee. A lot of the training is done by experts. A lot of the training is done by returning citizens themselves who talk about their own experience and role play with the mentors. And then after that, we ask for 6 to 8 hours a month, and we ask for a one-year commitment. And then we'll match you up with a incarcerated man or woman of the same gender, and the exciting work begins.
And you conclude your training at 3 in the morning?
And we conclude our training at 3 in the morning, right. No, we do it early evenings and Saturday mornings
mm-hmm.
Over a couple-week period, and we try to keep it interesting.
So in talking with Faye Landry, mm-hmm. My thought was is that she would people would lean too much on her, you know, mm. and in fact her concern was they weren't leaning enough on her,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that she wanted to be sure when she was hooked up with a mentee that this was a person that was going to actually need, you know, come to her for some help.
Right.
Is that more common?
A lot of people are very excited about our program inside.
Mm-hmm.
That's the good news. And then only some of them actually stick with it once they get out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because some of them get out and start using again. Some of it is
sure.
they get out, and some of them get out and start doing really well and just don't want anything that's associated with
right.
with their incarceration and just sort of want to move on. So it can be for any number of different reasons, but we do lose a fair number of people once they get out, just sort of don't call us back, and that's
certainly if somebody's sliding, the last thing they want to do is call their mentor.
We try to work with them in a way that we build up enough of a relationship while they're still in,
mm-hmm.
and we have enough of a non-judgmental presence that hopefully even if they're sliding, they're able to say, hey, really starting to get into some bad stuff again, and we can say, I'm sorry to hear that. I'm glad you were able to come to me. I'm happy to talk about it. I'm happy to be here for you, whether you're clean and sober or whether you're a mess again. So we certainly make our best effort to be present for people in whatever state they happen to be.
Does the mentor reach out to the mentee, or does the mentor
Both.
Kind of rely
Both.
No, on...
They each have each other's phone numbers,
mm-hmm.
and we definitely reach out to them. I reach out to them. The mentor reaches out to them.
Mm-hmm.
But also, especially with the homeless population, they're losing their phone, they're changing their phone number, it can be a host of different things.
Right.
You know, their number's disconnected, you know. But then there are the success stories, the people that we got jobs at the thrift store, or jobs at a construction site, that are happily back with their families and thriving. And people have been in mentor-mentee relationships for even past the 6 months that was supposed to be the length of it, but they still stay in touch.
So like a construction job, is that something, like, is there a person that's in charge of finding jobs and where you go, well, this sounds like a person that I know Bill over here is going to would be willing to hire?
Exactly. We now have an employment specialist on staff, who is actually one of our volunteer mentors, who's now a staff person and who works with most of our people, and even some people who we don't match up for mentors, but just want to have employment help, and helps them with job training, with resume development, with finding jobs, with knowing employers who will hire people with a felony record. It's not easy, but it's the work we've signed up for.
So when somebody is trying to get a job, how much do they have to reveal about their record? Right. Do they have to reveal all of it? What's the state of the law on that?
So the state of the law is that they, here in California, they ban the box, as they called it, where they no longer check a box saying, I have been convicted or I haven't. But before they make you an offer, they often will just look you up, and or they'll make you an offer and then they'll look you up.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's public record.
Sure.
So we generally encourage people to get out in front of it and to share and to talk about how they've made mistakes and here were the mistakes and they've done their time and here's also their good skills and here's how they've turned their life around. And because most employers will look into it and find out. So better to be out in front of it.
We're talking with Rabbi Seth Castleman, who is the head of the Exodus Project here in the Diocese of Sacramento. Seth, how early in the process does the mentor hook up with the mentee? Like somebody who's got 6 more months to serve or 2 months or maybe is already out?
The whole range. We'll start as early as 9 months before they get out.
Mm-hmm.
The average is maybe 3 or 4 months. Some people get out and then we match them up after. That's a little harder, but if the person is really motivated, we can make that work too. But the ideal is that the mentor is going down to the jail and visiting them a number of times before they're released. So it's usually about 3 to 4 months. Next week I'll be going out, since we have this big cohort that we're training right now of new mentors. I'll go out to the jail and do my presentations and hand out applications next week, and then for it to recruit new men and women. And then we'll go back a week or two later and interview the ones that applied and match them up.
So you'll make arrangements with the jail, and you'll go make let's say in a non-COVID environment, you'll go speak to a room full of inmates.
Exactly.
And talk
share
to
the work that we're doing on behalf of St. Vincent de Paul and the diocese, and recruit, and then answer questions, and then hand out applications, and then the incarcerated men and women fill out the applications and hand them back in to the deputies who scan them and email them to us. And then I go in and interview one-on-one each of the people that apply.
Have they been sort of pre-screened or selected before they come to the big meeting, to the big introductory meeting?
To some extent, in that a lot of the people we're working with are in what's called reentry, which is sort of a bit more of a social service rehabilitative model that the sheriff's department has for through the jail. So some of them are sort of already on track, already have a social worker, already have an employment person, already taking classes and getting trainings inside. Some of them are just in the general population. Some of them are actually in a gang, sort of dropped out from gangs and dropped out from the criminal lifestyle recovery unit, some of the more hardcore guys. So we take sort of the whole range.
Can you tell with the mindset, are most of the mindset that I'm going to get out and try to become a law-abiding citizen, or are most of them of the mindset, or percentage of them of the mindset, I can't wait to get out and go back to what I was doing?
Most of them that apply for our program are very much of the former. I really want to change. The hard part is that when you're dealing with a long-standing drug or alcohol addiction,
right,
as we know, that's a hard change to make. And it's a hard thing to kick. And it's a hard thing to kick while you're in jail, but in jail you have little or no access to getting it.
Right.
When you're out on the street, or you're out back at home, or you're back with your drinking buddies and your using buddies, and the stress starts to come into your life again, that's the hard part. And that's what sort of often is what drives people back down a bad road.
And how can your mentor deal with substance abuse?
Well, there's a way in which the mentor is, one of the roles that the mentor plays is as a sponsor mm-hmm. and somebody that they can call, hopefully before they use, when they're starting to feel the urge, to give them a text, to call them and say, hey, I really need to talk, or maybe after the fact to help them get back on their feet and start with another day. The mentor can help them find an NA or AA group. The mentor might even go with them. If it wasn't COVID, now most of the groups are online at the mm-hmm. moment, but mm-hmm. the mentor can help them hook up with resources. We can help them get the assessment to possibly go into a treatment program, inpatient or outpatient, through the county. So those are some of the pieces that can be helpful.
How much more difficult, you know, you say so much of this is on Zoom now, how much more difficult is it for a mentee yeah. to access services, especially in an emergency or semi-emergency, yeah. Given COVID and all the restrictions, and I can't just go see somebody at their right. office kind of thing?
Right. It is tough. It is tough. You know, they meet with us at our office about employment, and they need to get their Social Security card, they need to get a driver's license, but the DMV has been closed, and the yeah. Social Security office is closed, and so things, and then all the more so for healthcare and for mental health, and things are definitely tougher. We do what we can, and it's harder for the mentors. Some of our mentors are older and haven't wanted to do in-person visits until they got the vaccine. So that's been a tough part of it too, is trying to keep everybody safe, but still trying to be there for our men and women that we're trying to serve.
When you meet one-on-one with a potential mentee, what are you looking for, and are you looking as to whether or not this person would be a good match, or as to who you might match them with?
Both, exactly. So I have my list of my available mentors, and I'm not just partly I'm thinking, is this person sincere? Is this person seeming like somebody who is going to put in the effort and stick it out and really try and hopefully make a better turn in their life, and then also who do I have that would be a good fit for them? And mm-hmm. share a faith background, maybe share some hobbies or interests, or just sort of share some things that feel like would be a good fit. Because a lot of it is about the chemistry, and sometimes I make a good match, and sometimes I'm a matchmaker that they get divorced.
So, I think it was. I can't remember if it was Faye or Troy. Troy had said it was kind of like the dating game.
Right.
But
right.
So
when I match them up, I say that both of them have the option to say no if they don't think it's a good match. Both the mentor and the mentee, I sit with them. The three of us sit together in the first meeting, and then afterwards, I talk to both the mentor and the mentee and say, "Do you think it's a good fit?" And if either of them say, no, I want to stick with the program, but I don't think this is a good fit, mm-hmm. then I'll match them up with somebody else.
Does that happen very often?
No, not too often. I mean, sometimes people say, this seems like it's going to be a little tough, but I'll give it a try. But occasionally, one person said, I thought my mentor was going to be a little young for me. I wanted somebody that would be older. Mm-hmm. And so I matched that young mentor up with another young mentee, and that was a good fit. And so occasionally.
Are there sort of guideposts for mentors where, you know, you don't cross that line or you don't cross this line?
Sure, yes. No, we have definite boundaries. The do not cross ones around no intimate sexual relationships,
sure.
of course, no exchange of money, no intoxication, no illegal, I say, no illegal behavior except if you're driving them in the car and you speed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that may happen, and that is technically breaking the law, and that's
right.
In my book, that's okay. But any other illicit behavior when you guys are together, absolutely not. And then there are other ones that are more sort of the permeable boundaries about, you know, taking them in your car, sharing your personal information,
mm-hmm.
telling them about your life, things like that. That maybe you don't do at first, but as time passes and you've gotten to know them over months, you might start to share more.
Talk a little bit about the faith element. I know, of course, the most of all the major religions, when they set out to help people, they do it without questions. I know certainly in my Catholic faith,
mm-hmm.
Catholic Charities, St. Vincent de Paul, they're not asking you if you're Catholic or what you
right.
are. They're there
right.
to help you.
Right.
But is there a faith element?
There is most definitely a faith element in a couple of different ways. One is most of the mentors come with some amount of faith themselves. The majority are Catholic, understandably, mm-hmm. but we have Protestant, we have Jewish, we have Muslim, we have people that are very much atheist and non-religious mm-hmm. as mentors, but the majority of them are coming with a faith background and are motivated by that faith to do this service work. So it's sort of, first and foremost, it's the foundation on which we're building our own work and our own motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, if it's something of interest to the mentee, then it can be something where it's a discussion, where it's something that's talked about, where it's even to the point of going to worship together. I mm-hmm. often say that for a returning citizen, the walk from the curb to the pew on a Sunday morning or whatever day they worship is a long and lonely walk, and it's hard.
Sure.
You've been walked up to come back and try to rejoin or to join a new faith community. And
amen to that. That's exactly right.
So to be able to go with your mentor and to have them go with you and maybe make the introduction to mm-hmm. the priest or the minister or the rabbi or the imam or the whoever the faith leader may be can go a long way. Sometimes they do Bible study together. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they do, even when they're inside, sometimes they're studying a book together, reading a book together and discussing it, which could be a faith book. But again, we don't proselytize and we don't push it.
Right.
But if they're open to it, we're open to it as well.
Good, good. Yeah, that's, you know, it's so important. And I know the last thing you want to do I remember there used to be all these, you used to call them gospel missions or something, and you, mm-hmm. you know, we're not going to feed you till
right.
till we
right.
go through a few verses here. and, you know, but that seems to have pretty much gone out in the modern day. Seth, we're flat out of time. I wish we had more time, but hopefully we can get you back on. And how can people learn more about the Exodus Project?
Thank you, Bob. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. People can go to exodus-project.org, the word exodus, E-X-O-D-U-S, and then a dash, and then project.org. We're also on the diocese website. If you do a search on the diocese website, on the Sacramento Diocese website for Exodus, you can find us there as well. And our phone number and email and all of that is on both those sites.
Very good. Very good, Seth. We'll look forward to talking to you again soon. God bless you and your family, and let's get through this COVID thing.
Thank you, Bob. God bless you. Yeah. Take good care.
Thanks so much. That's Seth Castleman, who is the director of the Exodus Project here in the diocese. Just a great project. I know, a lot of difficult road to hoe for a lot of people. And a lot of great volunteers that are making it go, making a difference in people's lives. And I would highly recommend if you have an inclination in that way, that it is, these are God's children. These are people that are made the image and likeness of God, just like everybody else. And reaching out to them, in Matthew 25, Jesus talks about visiting those who are in prison. He doesn't specifically mention the Exodus Project, but I think that's covered in Matthew 25. And it's one of the things that we're asked to do. And I know it's definitely not for all people, but if it is for you, and the two we talked to, Troy and Faye, they were really profoundly affected by it, and you can tell they're doing great work. So if you go to scd.org, that's the Sacramento Catholic Diocese, and look up the Exodus Project, and you can or go to Exodus Project Sacramento, and you can find it there as well. That's going to do it for us for today. Thanks for listening. God bless.
Bow down.